Welcome back, folks. We have been bringing forward a lot of information about the big, beautiful bill today on many different fronts. And Guy Williams joins us, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, and we'll talk about the economic impact of the big, beautiful bill. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Guy, let's start with absolutes, because there's a lot of things in this bill that have yet to reveal itself. We're not exactly sure how it's going to work. But one thing that we know for sure, if the bill had not passed, there would have been a $4.5 trillion tax hike at the end of this year, because the 2017 tax regime that was set up would go away. It expires, right? So what happens at this point in time with this economy with a $4.5 trillion tax hike?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people forecast what will the bill do. And, you know, you have groups like Penn Wharton, Tax Foundation, Tax Policy Group, CBO, Council of Economic Advisors, and BBC. Interestingly, all of them forecast that GDP will actually increase as a result of the bill passing. So the economy will be bigger. Some of the increases are small. Tax Foundation, you know, 40 basis points. Some are bigger. CA Economic Advisors, 2.4 to 4.9. But the point is, as you point out, if it had not passed, the taxes would have gone up by $4.5 trillion. And that would be a challenge to an economy that is really in a bit of a transition right now, coming out of COVID, coming out of high interest rates. Many people use the higher standard deduction. If it had not passed, a lot of people would have been pushed back to having to itemize deductions and have a smaller tax refund. So the negative of it not passing would have been less income for essentially all income brackets.
Now, because we know that this has been in place since 2017, what we hear from Democrats is that this tax relief was all about the wealthy. What does the evidence show after these years that, you know, since that period of time that we've been under this tax regime?
Well, really not true. And I mean, there are ways to phrase that and say it's all about the wealthy. If you reduce rates, people that make more income get a bigger benefit because they're making more. But the 2017 bill lowered rates for everybody. And essentially at the lower income, you know, bottom 25%, bottom 50%, people got very close to paying no federal income tax. So significant reductions and also simplification because of the increased standard deduction. So we reached a point where it was a lot simpler to file your taxes. And one of the things that the bill did is it just provided certainty. Because of federal rules, you have to pass bills to fit into certain guidelines within a 10-year window. So these benefits were going to expire. And what this does is provide certainty. And that is incredibly important for planning. So when you're trying to figure out what's going to happen next, the certainty of knowing that the changes are permanent makes a very positive difference for the economy. It helps corporate planning, it helps individual planning, and it helps estate planning.
So the tax cuts of 2017 as a result of the big, beautiful bill are now permanent, right?
Yes, and some of them are increased. I mean, they're a number of different changes, but the estate tax actually went up a little bit, and that's gone up to $15 million a person, $30 per couple. And it's intriguing because people often talk about the estate tax as a way to reduce family fortunes. The most interesting economic studies on this show that if you don't want to have family fortunes, you eliminate the estate tax altogether. And it seems counterintuitive. It's like, why would you do that? If you have no estate tax, rich people don't need to plan and just pass it on without any tax. But what happens is the second and third generations just spend the money. And by the time you reach a few generations later, like the Rockefellers, after three generations, there were no millionaires left. If you eliminated the estate tax, you actually might have that same effect. What happens with an estate tax is wealthy families get attorneys, accountants, and they really work hard to create trust to preserve the family wealth for generations. So it's as I say, counterintuitive, but if you don't want to have big family fortunes, it might be better to have no estate tax. It's not a big part of federal revenue, and this codifying 15 and 30 does help planning. So for the vast, vast majority of Americans, there's no need to do tax planning on estates because there really effectively is no estate tax.
Now, one of the other things that is certain is that the change to SALT, state and local tax deduction, moving from under the 2017 Trump bill, which was going to expire, that didn't go away. They actually increased it to $40,000. And did they make that permanent?
No. And that was interesting. That is set up as only a five-year adjustment. And this was because of certain Republican members that are in high tax districts. It is intriguing because the same people that said, you know, the tax bill only favors the wealthy were also proposing bigger SALT deductions, which obviously you have to be fairly wealthy to have state and local taxes that are more than $10,000. So that is a five-year period, and the idea is that'll set up negotiations at the end of 5 years with other changes that were only made for a temporary time period.
What's interesting is that was actually pushed really hard by Democrats as well, right, for the increase in SALT. They've been complaining about that since 2017.
They have, and as I say, you also had a group of swing state Republicans. Had it not been for them, you know, it might not have increased. I was a little surprised they didn't go for something like a 20,000 SALT. Say, look, we're going to double this, but went all the way to 40. And, you know, sometimes you have to make unusual compromises in order to get bills passed. And, you know, it's easy to forget as we sit on the outside that when you have a very thin majority, you have to compromise. And, you know, politics is ultimately the art of the possible, is what can you get through with the members that you have. And so this was sort of the price of getting it through. You had to increase the SALT deduction from 10 to 40.
There are a couple of other things that are absolutes, but I'd rather give you the opportunity to highlight what other factors you think are important in this bill and what their economic impact may be.
Yeah. One is interesting, which is GOMESA, which is a Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act. That's how we get severance money in Louisiana on oil and gas extraction. And if you get back in the time machine all the way back to the days of Earl Long and Leander Perez, state of Louisiana in 1947 drilled the first offshore well. It was 16 feet deep, and it was a revelation. And, of course, as soon as it occurred, the federal government and the state government wanted to tax it. That's the nature of government. Whenever something new occurs, let's find a way to tax it. Harry Truman said, everything that's submerged is federal. And the state of Louisiana objected, filed the lawsuit. Sam Rayburn, and he's famous now. If you go to Washington, you go to the Rayburn office building, met with a Louisiana delegation and said, look, here's a deal. We will make a deal with you that the first two-thirds of the first 3 miles, you'll get two-thirds of the revenue, state of Louisiana. The rest, you'll get an uncapped 37.5%. Leander Perez and Earl Long said, no, we can get a better deal. They didn't take the deal. Harry Truman said, well, tough luck. The state lost literally tens of billions of dollars over that bad decision. We would have the money to have had the greatest universities in the world, the best roads, the best levees, but we missed that opportunity. GOMESA is the current law. and it is the same 37.5%, but it's capped at $375 million. Well, Steve Scalise and others bumped the cap to $500 million, and in the Tax Act, it bumps to $650 million. But this is not just us. This is Texas, Louisiana, and Alabama. We get about 44%. So what this means is about $70 million of annual recurring revenue to the state of Louisiana. So you talk about things that are specific to states. This is specific to our three states. And we will now have $70 million of recurring revenue. And that'll go on. And that money can be used for flood protection, coastal restoration, infrastructure changes that are necessitated by any oil and gas production. So a very positive thing tucked into the deal. Nowhere near as good as the deal we could have had before, because it's still capped at $650 million. The uncapped deal was on the table and then off the table. Unfortunately, our politicians don't always take the best deal when it's available.
Guy, we've heard a number of politicians. We just heard from one of the members of the Public Service Commission saying that this bill will increase utility cost. I've looked through this for 3.5 days now and haven't been able to figure out where connecting those dots, how that happens. Have you?
Yeah, I know where the argument comes from, but I don't think that it makes rational sense. The argument is, clean energy projects that are started this year will still get the benefit of the Biden Clean Energy Act. So if you start them this year, you still get all the tax credits that are in that bill. If you start next year, 60%, 2027 will be 20%, and zero thereafter. So the logic is these projects would have generated cheap power, but cheap power would have reduced utility cost. The unfortunate reality is the projects generate unstable power, whether it be wind or solar. And, yeah, when the sun's shining, it could be wonderful. Or when the wind's blowing, it could be wonderful. But when it's not, you need base power, either nuclear or natural gas or coal. And you still have to support that. So when you increase the clean energy, it has other benefits, but it doesn't reduce utility cost. So the states that have the most clean energy, that have pushed the hardest, have really not seen a reduction in utility cost. And California is probably the poster child. They've worked as hard as they can to reduce utility cost and increase clean energy. Well, they've increased clean energy, but they did not reduce utility cost. And the challenge is, whenever you do a variable clean energy project like solar, like natural gas, like wind, you need to have the transmission lines. And nobody has cut through the regulatory thicket to put the transmission lines to connect where the power is generated to where it's used. And we also haven't solved the storage problem. So the idea that this will increase utility cost is pretty imaginary. One of the economic realities that people ignore is the viability of a project is inversely proportional to the federal subsidy required to make it happen. So, in other words, if you have a very big federal subsidy required or the project just won't happen, then the project is probably not economically viable. And that's true of energy, it's true of housing, it's true of any other federal project. So if it makes sense, industry will do it because it's logical, and we will have greater adaption of solar, greater adaption of wind, and the perfect example are the windmills out in West Texas where the wind blows all the time. Those make economic sense. It's good for the farmer who uses land. It's also good for the state. But cutting these subsidies is not going to increase utility bills.
Interestingly, because almost every study, almost every review of the viability of those industries at the present time, because of the enormous by the federal government and otherwise, is that no one has seen reduced energy costs, right? I mean, I hadn't seen a study yet that in any state that's deployed these technologies to any extent reduced energy costs?
Not yet. And I mean, the technology makes sense. And I think if we allow it to be adapted at a rational rate based upon the economy, you'll see some practical changes. But when you push it faster than the economy allows and faster than current technology allows, you end up subsidizing something that is pretty inefficient, and it makes the grid less stable, which is very unfortunate. And we saw that with the blackouts in Louisiana because of the lack of north-south connectivity. So it's one of those things that will work out over time, but it's not something that you can push faster than the physics and the economics will allow.
Yeah. All right, let's get to a break, and when we come back, I know that we'll talk about Medicaid and other issues in this bill, and we'll be right back. We're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, and we're talking about the economic impact of the big, beautiful bill. Give us a shout on the Oakland Heart Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, and we're talking about the economic impact of the big, beautiful bill. Obviously, a lot of consternation and conflict is over Medicaid spending. I don't know if you're prepared to talk about that, Guy.
Oh, yeah. Medicaid is one of the challenges that the U.S. faces. Medicaid spending has gone up 60% since 2019. Now, think about that, 60% increase. What the bill does is it reestablishes and sets up some accountability so that individuals that are able-bodied, not pregnant women, not people taking care of elderly relatives, have to work 80 hours a month. And so it adds this work requirement or volunteer in a nonprofit. It doesn't start tomorrow. Nobody's being kicked off of the program immediately. It starts not next year, but the following year. And what states are required to do is validate and confirm that the people that are on Medicaid are actually working. Now, this is something that used to be popular on both sides of the aisle. Bill Clinton passed the personal responsibility and work requirement in 1996. And his requirement actually was tougher than this because it said, you know, after you've been on the program for 2 years, what was then known as welfare, you had to work. And the lifetime cap, you could only be on the program for 5 years. If you were able-bodied, that was it. And it didn't increase poverty. It actually pushed people out of welfare and into work. So the objective of this is to bend the trajectory of Medicaid so that it's not growing so rapidly, because it is a tremendous problem for the federal budget. And the idea is also that it's better for people to work than to sit at home. You know, studies that have looked at people, able-bodied people that are on Medicaid that aren't working, find that the number one activity is watching TV. The number two activity is playing video games. And it's just not productive for the people that are doing it. It's not productive for our country. And, you know, if you had kids that were doing that, you wouldn't be very happy with them. You'd say, look, y'all need to get a job. You can't, it's not good for you. It's not good for your self-respect, not good for the community. So the bill doesn't gut Medicaid. It doesn't even reduce spending in Medicaid.
So
spending will still go up.
Let me ask you something. Let me go through a math exercise. I'm trying to wrap my head around what these people are saying. People are going to die. There's that. I mean, it's on and on and on. So they're talking about a $1.3 trillion cut over 10 years, right?
Right.
So if I take 1.3 trillion and I divide it by 10, that's $130 million a year, right?
Yes.
And let's just divide that equally amongst the 50 states. So we divide it by 50. It's $2.6 million to each state over a 10-year period of time. And we're talking about people dying. I can't connect these dots mathematically.
Well, it's interesting. The Congressional Budget Office made a couple of interesting assumptions. One is that 4.8 million people will not bother to do the 40 hours a month of volunteering of work, and they will therefore not have medical care. But then it takes the leap of assuming that if they don't have medical care, they won't go to the hospital, won't go to the emergency room if they're sick, which seems a bit illogical. I would think most people, given the option, would actually go to work and really be better off. So the people will die is an exaggeration. It's used to stir up emotion. And you're right. I mean, this is a big program. It's growing fast. The program will continue to grow. I mean, this is not an actual cut in dollars. And it is only, the only cut is if people choose and say, look, I'm not going to work. I'd prefer to sit on the couch. And look, we know entry-level jobs are available. We talk to people in our hotel industry in New Orleans. Look, we'll hire people. We always have openings. We're looking for people who want to work. So the idea, as I say, is something that used to be popular on both sides of the aisle, which is let's get people the dignity of a job as opposed to a check from the government, or in this case, Medicare, Medicaid, which is provide for the government. The other thing that is happening is it cuts back on what almost looks like a flim-flam deal. States currently are allowed to tax providers. They tax the providers, the health care providers, and then they use the money as the state match to get more federal dollars, which they then pay back to the providers and have hold harmless agreements so that whoever is the provider ultimately ends up better off because of the state tax. And this bill says, look, that's really not the intention. The intention of the original legislation was that the feds would put in some of the money, the state would put in some of the money. You're creating a shell game of taxing providers, using that as your match, and then increasing the payment to the same providers that paid the tax. So what happens is that's currently maxed out at 6% of revenue at hospitals and other providers. That's going to go down to 3.5%, but it's phased in starting at the end of next year, 50 basis points a year. So that sort of shell game of reimbursing providers will also be reduced. Now, this doesn't mean the state can't make up the difference. It just means that you can't create an imaginary circle of dollars in it to make your federal match. And that's one of the things people are saying, well, folks are going to die because of this change. It's more likely that hospitals will become more efficient. States will provide their share of the money as it was intended in the first place when the bill was passed.
Yeah, and I do want to correct myself. I think folks are texting saying I said million. I'm looking at my calculation. It's actually billion. So I do stand corrected. It would be 2.6 billion. If I said million, I apologize because I'm looking at my math calculation and that's not what it is. It's not million. It's actually billion. But the point I was trying to make is that when you're looking at the budgets of these states over the 10-year period of time, that's not, you know, a mind-numbing number where, you know, they would allow people to die and that the state can't make up the difference, right?
And once again, you're presuming that that folks choose not to work. You're presuming mm-hmm. that those who choose that still don't want to work will not go to the hospital, and therefore they'll get sicker, and therefore there are a lot of steps to people will die. And I think that's an exaggeration because it plays well on TV. The other thing is the adjustments to the food stamp program, which is called the SNAP program now. And what the bill says is, look, we're going to look at the error rates. A lot of states have significant errors in eligibility. and the errors all tend to lean toward much larger eligibility and not verifying income. And what the bill says is, look, if you have an error rate that is higher than 6%, there can be a reduction of 5% of benefits. Now, if it is really an egregious error, the reduction can be 15%. But this is actually calling the states to reduce the errors. And in this particular, I have no sympathy because there are several laws that bankers have to comply with, one being a Bank Secrecy Act, and the federal standard is zero errors. I mean, not 1%, not one half, zero. You're not supposed to have any mistakes, and it's a complex rule. So if the feds can hold us to zero errors, I don't think 6% is unreasonable. I mean, it's just not that hard to work your processes. And this is another one. People will starve. People will have no food. Only if you don't fix your errors, and it's only a reduction in the federal payment. It's not zero. It starts out at a 5% reduction. So
And I had this conversation earlier with Dr. Jennifer Evagno about, so what is the entity to do? You want to make sure that the people that are entitled to get it, but those that are not entitled to get it, that they don't get it. I mean, that just kind of makes sense. And by the way, the current SNAP program actually has a work requirement of 20 hours a week, or you lose benefits after 3 months. And, you know, so, and they give you that 3 month dispensation, you know, in case, you know, there you have a setback, even though you're not eligible during that 3 month period of time. So it seems to me they're more than accommodating here, but we just can't willy nilly be giving out money. If you set up program directives, program requirements, It's as if, you know, some of the critics are saying, well, we don't really mean those. Really? I mean, it's like, then why do we have them?
Yeah, and it gets back to a different philosophy. There are people that believe Medicare and Medicaid should be free, that we basically should have socialized medicine, and medicine is available to anybody, period, and I understand the logic of that, but that's not the system that we have. And if you don't pay attention to the guidelines, you're actually subsidizing people that aren't eligible and reducing the amount available to people that really are. So asking for a standard of accountability is not unreasonable. And as I say, a work requirement, there's just no social studies that show that not working is healthy, that it's mentally healthy, it's physically healthy, or it's healthy for a community. It's just better if people get into the workforce, a better sense of self-esteem, better example for children, and better for the economy as a whole. So these work requirements, I don't think are egregious, that they're phased in, and the assumption that people are going to be kicked off is based upon the assumption that people will just choose to do nothing. And I have more faith in people. I think when faced with a choice, they'll say, no, okay, it was nice to sit on the couch, but I am going to go back to work.
Yeah. We got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We're talking about the economic impact of the Big Beautiful Bill. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We're talking about the economic impact of the Big Beautiful Bill. Guy, so does this bill actually impact universities?
It does, and it's interesting. I think it's an example of what happens when you go on one side of the political ledger and you don't have any friends on the other. Rich colleges got a tax increase. Everybody else got a tax decrease. They got a tax increase. So, right, what's happening in the big bill is, if you have above $2 million in endowment per student, you have a tax rate of 8% on your income, and that is up from 1.5%. If you have $750,000 to $2 million, you have a tax rate of 4%, and then $500,000 to $750,000 per student, $1.4 million. So coincidentally, the universities that hits are the ones that the president seems to be maddest at, Princeton, Yale, MIT, Stanford, Harvard, all are in that category. And the ones that have the above $2 million are Princeton, Yale, and MIT all have more than $2 million of endowment. So there's actually an increase in taxes. The other thing is there's a reduction in the amount of the graduate student loans. And this is something we've talked about before. It's just some of the graduate student loans really weren't productive, very expensive. Most people defaulted and didn't lead to good income. The poster children, of course, you know, Columbia had their film studies program that just essentially nobody ever repaid their loan. But you had other universities with the same sort of thing. So graduate loans are now capped at $100,000. And with the exception of things like medical and law, at $200,000. So you have a cap in graduate loans, which is probably worthwhile because a lot of people were getting degrees that, that just didn't pay for themselves. As I say, the worst were Columbia, NYU, and USC of the private schools had some very low repayment. And then of the for-profit schools, University of Phoenix, Walden, and DeFry also had graduate programs with essentially no repayment program. So this is going to address that. And I think that's something that, that will make sense going forward. One of the things we've talked about is high student loans actually led to above inflation increases in tuition. And so now with these caps, you won't be able to raise tuition on these programs above inflation. And I think the other thing that people forget is just because you can't get a federal loan doesn't mean you have other options. You could, there's still private loans. If the program makes sense, if you're likely to have a career, like you're going into pharmacy or something like that, you can get a private loan to repay it. But there are now some caps in this federal student program.
So this attempt, it kind of partially addresses this problem that we have with the borrowing of money. But obviously, we still have a huge problem. And I just want to make sure that everyone understands when someone defaults, the taxpayers are the ones picking up the bill, right?
Oh, exactly. There's no fairy godmother out there. If you don't pay your bill, the rest of us have to pay it. And I mean, the poster children for that are the people that work two and three jobs to pay off their student loans, lived in substandard housing, and just wanted to get their loans paid back. And we have a number of employees and customers that tell stories of what they went through to get their student loans paid. And if you don't pay your loan, then those taxpayers have to pick up the difference. The other change is there are now going to be only two repayment options. You'll have the fixed program that goes from 10 to 25 years, or the repayment assistance program, and that goes up to 30 years with, depending on income, 1 to 10% of discretionary income. So it's streamlining out a lot of the different programs, and it really is important. We still have a number of people that think that there's going to be some new magic bullet, and this settles the issue. We now have the two programs. If you're in default under the old program or you haven't started repaying your student loan, it's vitally important that you do it because those loans are that are in default are being reported to the credit bureau. And if you haven't paid, you will end up being denied mortgage loans. You'll have a hard time getting a quality apartment. And you also, because of the way credit card offers are made, you won't see the best offers. You know, the really good stuff will be for people with good credit scores, and people that have defaulted won't be in that group. So they'll start with higher price car loans, either a very expensive or no mortgage loan. So it's important to realize and to get back on track with the student loan and take one of the two options that's going to now be available.
Got text saying, with a lot of the savings in the bill, where does the money go? The reality is there's a spending portion to this bill that actually increases, right? So a lot of the immigration enforcement, the wall, and a lot of other things are funded. And that's basically where a lot of these savings are actually headed to. And they're not really savings because, as you said, all we did was the trajectory of the spend was altered.
Yeah, and if you exclude the extension of the tax credits, some analysts say that the bill will increase the deficit $70 to $100 billion a year. The most optimistic is BBC says no, it'll excluding the extension of the tax credits, it'll actually save about $100 billion a year. So, plus or minus $100 billion, which, and because the federal budget is so big, that's almost a jump ball. And you say, well, it could be either one. We really don't know. That's over a 10-year period. We know for sure Congressional Budget Office has never made an accurate prediction, so you have to take them off. But when you look at BBC, the Tax Foundation, it's somewhere between a plus or minus $100 billion. The challenge is we still have an unsustainable deficit, and we will have to address that in the future. And this bill just provides certainty. As I say, all of the different prognosticators say it'll actually increase GDP either by a little bit or pretty much a couple percent. So it does make things a bit better, but we can't feel that this solves all the problems. It does provide certainty for business, which is vitally important. You know, that was one of the things that's holding the economy back is the lack of predictability. So we right. gain predictability. This is either a plus or minus $100 billion after the extension of the existing law. And then the deficit problem in the future, you and I are going to have to work on that. Maybe we can get Washington to pay attention.
Yeah, good luck with that one. That's bigger than me, maybe not you, but bigger than me for sure. As always, we truly appreciate the time, the insight. Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Have a great week, my friend.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We'll visit with Scoot to see what he has coming your way. Stay with us. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
No, we'll talk about the horrific flooding in Texas. You know, we have flooding here, but it's not like that kind of flooding. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the Epstein files, and we'll talk about some of the problems with Essence Fest, and we'll talk to people who were there.
All righty, Scoot's headed your way, folks. Stay tuned. Hope you have a great Monday evening. See you in the morning.